Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you're listening to Total EM. Today marks the anniversary of 9/11, and on this somber day, it's hard to really talk about anything too specific without at least thinking about all those that we lost that day. But something that comes to mind, something I've thought about in the past and thought maybe this was a good discussion for it today, was talking about certain firefighter-related injuries. And it's not technically just for firefighters. We're talking about anyone who's exposed to these unique conditions. But we're going to talk about smoke inhalation and then certain toxicologies that develop as a result of being exposed to smoke and the chemicals that can be in it. With this in mind, firefighters get exposed to all sorts of issues every single day of their job. They have to deal with not only long hours, overtime, and the physical stress, but they also have PTSD, risk of cancer, and other long-term disabilities as a result of their unique exposures. But one thing classically firefighters are known for are eating smoke. And that's a term that we use for it. And it's something that we see quite a bit where firefighters come in because of smoke-related injuries. We also see this, of course, with fire victims where patients were exposed, they were caught in a house fire or what other type of structure fire, maybe just outside for too long in smoky conditions, and they come up with the same complaints. So when we're talking about this, we're not only talking about firefighters, we're talking about anyone who's exposed to these unique environments. And I want to make sure to emphasize that because there's kind of a generalized approach in how we move forward with managing these patients and making sure that we're doing the right things for them. While we're talking about firefighters for a second, though, let's not only talk about some of the experiences that happen just from the smoke, but sometimes the long-term effects with it, too. Keep in mind that many of the things that is in the smoke is carcinogenic in nature, and so there's a long-term risk for cancer with this. There's also the chemicals that then rest on the clothes and the skin. The skin is actually a primary source of cancer long-term by the way it gets absorbed. So it's very important that we encourage firefighters and anyone else who's in a hazardous environment to properly wear the appropriate personal protective equipment or PPE, and then their self-contained breathing apparatus or SCBA. That SCBA is providing them with a significant amount of respiratory protection, basically the best you can get in most cases, while also providing PPE for the face and stuff like that. But there's also the other PPE, the bunker gear, the actual layer of clothing in between, and everything else. So it's very important that good hygiene and good cleaning and good tactics to avoid unnecessary exposures is an absolute must when we're talking about this. There's also the issue with smoke in general, not only the acute issues that we see, but the long-term issues. There have been plenty of studies, and we're going to talk about just a couple of them really quick, where there were firefighters who, basically those who've been long-term firefighters, those who were experienced, 80% of the firefighters in one study had some sort of airway reactivity, whereas the new recruits had no airway reactivity when they were exposed to smoke. And this effect was not long-term in that study. It usually lasted for up to 6 hours, but not necessarily 24 hours when they did it. However, then there was another study done in Houston, Texas, with firefighters there, where 30 firefighters had severe smoke exposure. Out of them, 28 of them had symptoms initially. The most common symptoms in descending order are substernal chest pain or burning, headaches, burning eyes, dyspnea, and nausea. Although none of them originally had wheezing, they did have decreases in their forced vital capacity, or FVC, and their forced expiratory volume in 1 second, or FEV1. And this supports that, again, these occupational exposures have a lot of high risk for them, and we need to make sure that we're doing the right things to avoid unnecessary smoke exposure. Let's talk about, in general, about just being exposed to smoke. Now, obviously, there are chemical irritants. We're going to talk about that in a second. But the burns and just the heat of it can cause a lot of problems. And we see this a lot with fire victims in general, not just firefighters. So the things that we really want to worry about as early clues are like facial burns, hoarse voice, singed nasal hair, carbonaceous sputum or soot or carbonaceous material in the oral cavity. Later signs, things that would be even more concerning, are facial and oral edema, stridor, wheezing, dyspnea, and cyanosis. Although toxicology studies are great, they're not always available in our smaller shops. The other things we want to get are like CBC, CMP, ABG, plus or minus a VBG as well, EKG, and a chest x-ray. Again, advanced airway management should be something that you're considering right off the bat, because we do not want to delay intubation if this is a high-risk patient like we were just talking about above. Other things to factor in besides just the burns on the locations, but also respiratory distress and depression, ultra-middle status, or a very large area of burns, especially very big significant burns or circumferential burns around the throat or neck or stuff like that, because these tend to have higher risk for other complications that we don't always foresee right away. As I alluded to, it's not just the actual heat from the fire that's dangerous. There are plenty of things that require us to be cautious. And it's not just with the initial fire attack. It's not just the early stages of fire. Even after it's knocked down in what's called the overhaul process, where basically you're taking out the small embers and you're trying to look for other sources. You're basically trying to do salvaging at the same time. All these things are potentially dangerous. When they've done studies on this, even though they're within the NIOSH ceiling recommendations for what would be potentially allowed in a dangerous environment, those things, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, hydrogen cyanide, hydrogen sulfide, oxygen, all of them were technically within the recommended levels, but they still have shown that even in those environments, the genes that are impacting the proteins are related to inflammation-associated lung disease and cancer. So it's not just the original fire either, and it's not the smoke directly from the fire. It's also the overhaul process, as those chemicals linger around and can cause longer-term issue. Again, it's why it's so important that anytime there's products of combustion around, we need to be careful about encouraging the proper use of SCBA and PPE in general. So let's talk about some of the other potential hazards that we're going to see. And we're going to kind of go through it in almost a list-like fashion. So kind of hang around for this for a second, and then we're going to talk about the general approach to this too. As we've hinted at, I mean, there are all sorts of things in there. Two of the big ones we think about, but don't really think about as closely maybe as we should as some of the others, are chlorine and phosgene, because they are often in the byproducts that are being burned. And they both react with water in the respiratory tract and can form hydrochloric acid. So hydrochloric acid can be very serious. It's usually a combustion product of PVC, so like PVC pipes and stuff like that, that polyvinyl chloride. And for inhalational injuries, it can cause premature ventricular contractions or other arrhythmias, pulmonary edema, sometimes 2 to 12 hours later, dyspnea, and chest pain. So again, we want to make sure that we're watching out for this. Speaking of the chlorine, this is usually a bleach-type smell. In fact, a lot of times when people overchlorinate their pools, we'll see patients come in with kind of these upper respiratory kind of vague symptoms, the runny nose, sometimes itchy, watery eyes, coughing, sore throat, stuff like that. Usually it's just irritating, but in more extreme cases, it can cause airway edema. It can cause airway obstruction, and it can even go all the way up to laryngospasm. So we have to be careful. But again, supportive care is going to be the main thing with this. Phosgene, on the other hand, its low water solubility makes it heavier than air, and it increases the chance of damage to the lower respiratory tract. These are the ones we really want to worry about. The thing that people may classically connect with the toxidrome here is that freshly cut hay smell. And that freshly cut hay smell is going to sometimes be present, but not always. So it's something to keep in mind. And we see phosgene a lot in the manufacturing of plastics, dyes, pharmaceuticals, pesticides. So it's everywhere. And it can take hours for the respiratory symptoms to develop. So the things that we're looking for are like respiratory distress, cough, pulmonary edema. And although the main thing, again, is supportive care with oxygen, it can lead up to acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. And so we need to be ready for this. Again, unfortunately, the hydrochloric acid, the chlorine, and the phosgene don't have antidotes. But let's start talking about a few things that do have antidotes. One of the big ones that everyone will probably be thinking of is hydrogen cyanide. This one gets talked about a lot because there is a specific antidote. Actually, there are a couple of different versions of antidotes. The, again, classic Toxidrome. This is like the bitter almond smell, the cherry red skin, although that's even less common. The PO2, the venous blood, is going to be similar to the arterial blood. And there's usually going to be, or at least in many cases, can be the severe lactic metabolic acidosis that you really can't explain for some other reason. The preferred treatment these days is going to be the cyanokit, that's the hydroxycobalamin. Really, it's the better thing to use now, but in many smaller shops or certain other places, the cyanokits are not yet available. And so instead, there is this other option that is pretty common called the Lilly kit, and this is more second line. So it consists of amyl nitrate, sodium nitrite, and then sodium thiosulfate. This combination can be used, but there are some major issues with it. And actually, there's this great podcast by the Dentastic Mr. Tox and Howard Show, and definitely check it out. We're going to include that in the show notes. It's a little long podcast, much longer than what we normally do, but I like it because you'll get a lot of history. You'll understand why. You'll also learn about some of the studies and some of the future things they're looking at doing with this too. So this is definitely one not to ignore, but it's just so much detail and someone's done this really well already. I want to stick with what they've done, but keep in mind the big things are that hydroxycobalamin is first line, and then the Lilly kit of amyl nitrate, sodium nitrate, and sodium thiosulfate is the second line. Let's talk about another time that you can actually give a cyanide antidote, and that's with hydrogen sulfide. That's that rotten egg smell that we hear about. Again, the big thing is going to be that supportive care with high flow oxygen at 100% O2, but you can give the cyanokit for this as well. If the cyanokit's not available, so that hydroxycobalamin's not available, then you want to give that Lilly kit with the amyl nitrate and the sodium nitrite, but you don't want to give the thiosulfate portion. The theory here is that we're trying to increase the methemoglobin formation in blood, and that this will cause a conversion of sulfide to salt methemoglobin, which is less toxic. The main aspect to remember when you're trying to treat with these types of kits, though, is that what we're really aiming for, especially with the Lilly kit, is that methemoglobinemia can be induced. So methemoglobinemia can be induced, but you can also see methemoglobinemia from fires themselves. This is usually by hemoglobin oxidation from the heat of the fire, and that's that classic chocolate brown color of blood that you may see when you're drawing blood. Again, the SpO2 is going to be elevated, falsely so, until the higher levels start hitting, and the big management is going to be using methylene blue, except for with G6PD deficiency. You want to be careful to try and find that history ahead of time before you administer methylene blue. Speaking of those falsely elevated SpO2, we need to think about carbon monoxide. This is another thing we see a lot in fires and smoke in general. Smoke a lot of times has carbon monoxide in it. And obviously we have carbon monoxide alarms that we'll run across sometimes too. But the first symptoms are often just very vague. It's usually the headache type stuff, but it can rapidly progress in the right environment to unconsciousness and even death. So the big things to look for, again, are hypoxia, lactic acidosis, and hypotension. If you remember, a lot of times people will say hyperbaric oxygen is kind of like that gold standard treatment sort of thing, but it's really hard to get to. So a lot of times you just want to, again, give that 100% high flow oxygen, and then consider doing the cyanide kit that you would do for this other stuff, because a lot of times this will co-occur with that cyanide toxicity. So if you're going to treat for this, kind of treat it all together. There is a wonderful podcast by Scott Weingart on MCRIT where they talk about cardiac arrest management after smoke inhalation. They have toxicologist Dr. Lewis Nelson on there. I'm going to include this in the show notes too for you to check out, because I believe that this is, again, just something so well covered. Why repeat it all again when you can get this direct and hear about some other little clinical pearls that would take a lot more time to delve into? So let's summarize here real quick. Firefighters and fire victims are going to be exposed to smoke. Not only are we talking about the burns and the heat themselves, but also all the chemicals. Look for those telltale toxidromes. They may not always be present, but look for them. Consider administering the correct antidotes whenever possible to take care of this. The big things that we're looking for are trying to do toxicology studies whenever possible, CVC, CMP, ABG, and possibly a VBG, the pulse oximetry, the EKG, and the chest X-ray. In addition to this, again, a great history and physical can provide you with a lot of data and figure out how likelihood of risk this patient is. Keep in mind, a lot of these patients may necessarily be observed for a period of time, possibly overnight, to look for some of those slow, delayed symptoms that can happen. Again, in some cases, up to 12 hours later. The big thing to keep in mind, the way I think about this now, is high flow oxygen for pretty much everyone in every case, especially if there's any real concerns for it. And then also doing a cyanide kit whenever it seems indicated, which a lot of these sick patients, if you have the sicker end of these patients, really consider doing that cyanide kit. And as one last reminder, also remember to talk to your local toxicologist whenever possible, which in the United States is 1-800-222-1222. All right, that wraps up this podcast. It's meant to be a short one, but a very important one. Again, on this day, just remember all those that we lost in 9/11, all the important things that everyone does on a daily basis across all the first responder types and everyone else. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.